Hi, my name is Carla Lewis, and I'm the Gainsborough Branch Manager. Today's date is October 12, 2006. The person that I am interviewing is Mr. Earl Reynolds, Jr., and the location is the Gainsborough Branch Library. Earl, first question is, when and where were you born?
I was born April 7, 1951. Right here in Roanoke, Virginia, at Earl Memorial Hospital.
Okay. How long have you lived in the Gainsborough area?
All of my life. From the time I was born until the time I left to go to college, which was around 1969, and then back and forth throughout my professional working career.
Can you tell us the name of the streets that you lived on when you were in the Gainsborough area?
I've only lived in one location, 331 Harrison Avenue.
Tell me about your parents, your brothers, your sisters.
Well, my dad is Earl B. Reynolds, Sr., and he was an entrepreneur in the Gainsborough community. He was a barber, owned his own barbershop, which was located on Henry Street in the Gainsborough community. Moved the barbershop there from Park Street, which is still in the greater Gainsborough community, and most folks know it today as Fifth Street. My mom is Clara Frances Ferguson Reynolds, deceased, a Franklin County native, and my dad met her when she was just a teenager and courted her and waited for her to grow up, and then he married her. I have one sister, Shirley Jean Reynolds, who still lives with my dad at 331 Harrison Avenue in the Gainsborough community.
Did you have extended family living with you when you were living on in the Harrison Avenue in the Gainsborough area?
Yes, I did. Most of folks who lived in the Gainsborough community, were nuclear in terms of family relationships. There were grandmas and granddads and aunts and uncles all living together in the same household. Now, in my household, there was my dad, mom, my sister, myself, and my dad's mother and father, Guy Reynolds and Georgie Reynolds.
Okay, describe your house for us. For instance, was it brick? And did you have a large garden? That kind of thing.
The house is brick. It was built in 1921 by my uncle, A.B. Reynolds, who was the first president and obviously a member of the founding group of the Roanoke branch of the NAACP. And he worked for the railroad. He was a Pullman porter. He also was a barber. He taught my dad the barbering business when he was a kid and brought him along. And when he passed away, he willed the house to my dad as well as the barbering business.
What kind of activities did you participate in?
Oh, boy. There was a lot to do in the community. From a school perspective, there were like after-school programs. There was the Gainsborough Branch Library. There was the Hunton YMCA. There were activities sponsored by the community churches and other groups and organizations. So we stayed pretty busy.
What kind of work have you done throughout your life?
Well, my dad, at the age of five, decided to bring me slowly into the business. So at the age of five, he started to take me over to the barbershop and allow me to do such things as sweep the floor, shine shoes, those kinds of things. Of course, I was kind of short. I was really pudgy. I was a heavy little kid. So back in those days, the sodas were in bottles. They came in bottles. And one of the famous sodas, of course, was Coke. And my dad had a Coke machine in the barbershop. And they would always bring the bottles in these wooden crates. So I would take the bottles out of the crates, and I would stack the crates up so I could stand on them to do things. Like wash the windows, you know, the mirrors in the barbershop so the barbers could see what they were doing, and things like that. As I got older, I established a very successful shoeshine business on Henry Street. If you ask most people who came along during the time that I did, they would say that one of their memories would be getting their shoes shined in my dad's barbershop. One of my memories is shining the shoes of famous entertainers that stayed at the Hotel Dumas. One in particular was James Brown. And he brought his Revue to town, and they were playing the Star City Auditorium, which was located on Henry Street. And I guess I was about 7 or 8 years old. And he came out of the hotel with his entourage, you know, his valets and bodyguards and all those people. And right across the street from the hotel was my dad's barbershop. And next door to my dad's barbershop was Kaiser's music shop, record shop, that served primarily the black community, although they had customers from all over town. And the first place he went was in the record shop. And he actually signed an autographed picture for the owners, who were Mr. and Mrs. Kaiser. Napoleon and Louise Kaiser owned and operated their business, so he signed a picture for them. And they had this big display board in the record shop, where they displayed the pictures of all the entertainers that came in and had the signatures, their own signatures on the pictures. And obviously he wanted to find out how his record sales were going for certain records that he had out on the market at that time. Then he left there and he came in the barbershop. Well, he had his own personal valet, so he didn't need a haircut. I mean, you know, they took care of him from head to toe. And he did not need a shoeshine. But when he was growing up, he shined shoes. And so he looked at me and he said, "Would you shine my shoes?" And I looked at his shoes and I said, "But they don't need to be shined." And he looked at me and he says, "Well, let's shine them anyway." And so he got up on my shoeshine stand and I shined his shoes all over again. He got down and he looked at me and he said, "Thank you very much." And he said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "I don't know yet." And he said, "Stay in school, get your education." And he handed me a $5 bill. Now, in those days, it's like 1958, 1959, $5 was a lot of money. And so, his entourage took him out. He went back to the hotel, and of course he prepared himself for his show that night. And extremely, extremely impressive man, very businesslike, very organized. When they arrived on Henry Street, it was a, you know, he arrived in a spectacular way. They arrived on Henry Street with about 8 brand new travel buses. And the band, his entourage, the other entertainers that performed with him, all traveled in those buses. And of course, he had his own bus, his very own bus. It had his bedroom and his bathroom and his dressing room and all those things. And they parked those buses on Henry Street. And that was just some kind of sight to behold when they came across Henry Street, and people just came out of the shops. I mean, the world just stopped. You know, when the James Brown Review arrived on Henry Street.
Earl, what kind of work have you done throughout your life? You started telling us about your shoe shine business and all the different things that you've done, but continue your life. Bring us forth.
Well, one of the things that you learn by hanging around the barbershop is the work ethic. And everybody worked. You know, there was, you know, if you didn't work, people kind of looked at you like, you know, what's the problem? Because everyone could get a job doing something. And so I worked at my dad's barbershop, Shine Shoes. He taught me how to cut hair, although I never professionally cut hair. I would bootleg it, as they called it. I would cut hair after 5 o'clock, and it would generally just be my closest friends. I worked at Kaiser's Record Shop, right next door to my dad's barbershop. And I also worked a couple of other places on Henry Street, just doing odd jobs for some of the other business people. I worked at a hardware store, selling Christmas trees during the Christmas holiday. Now, I did that in addition to working in my dad's barbershop. During the winter months, weather, the climate has changed a lot here. But during the winter months, we always had snow. We had lots of snow. And, of course, the shoeshine business kind of got put on hold. So you got to find something else to do to supplement your income. So working at the hardware store was like supplementing my income during the winter months. And one of my primary jobs was in December. And I would organize the Christmas tree lot. And this was right on Shenandoah Avenue, still in the greater Gainesboro community. I would organize the Christmas tree lot. You know, I would receive the trees when the shipments, when they came in, and I would sell them. You know, and you know, I was pretty good at it. So every year they would call me and they said, you know, do you want to work in December? And I said, yeah. Whatever you could do to earn money. When I was in high school, I worked for the city of Roanoke. And that was back in the days when, you know, that they weren't all that particularly, I don't guess, about, you know, ages and all that kind of thing. So I worked for Public Works, the sanitation division, and that's how I learned the city, was from the back of a garbage truck. And I ran every route in the city. I knew every street. I knew every alley. I knew every nook and cranny in the city. And I did that all the way through college. As a matter of fact, I did it for 3 months after I finished college. Because I came home. My degree was in education. I wanted to teach. But they didn't have any teaching positions. And again, everybody works. You don't sit around the house. And so I didn't have a car. And so I got on my bicycle and I rode down to the Public Works division. And I saw the foreman that I had worked with for years. His name was Melvin Matthews. And I said, Melvin, I need a job. He said, Earl, but you just finished college. I said, Melvin, I need a job. And he said, I will let you work only if you promise that you'll get out there and you'll find a job. You know, something in line with your education. And I said, deal. So I worked for Melvin for about 2.5 months. And then I was hired at the Norfolk and Western Railroad in the car records office right over here on Jefferson Street. And I only worked for them for 30 days. And I got a letter from the State University of New York at Albany. It had kind of found me. They sent the letter to my old address in Fayetteville, North Carolina, where I went to undergraduate school. And they had to kind of find me, and it finally made its way back here to Roanoke. And it said that if you're still interested in coming to graduate school, come on. You've got a full scholarship and a stipend. And so I went to my supervisor at the railroad, and I said, I'm leaving. And he tried to talk me into staying, because back in those days, railroad jobs were gold. People fought for those jobs. And I was voluntarily giving up a railroad job. He said, your next step is to go into the management program. He said, the sky's the limit. Stay with the railroad. And I said, bye. And so I packed my bags again. And again, this was a family thing. My mother and her two brothers drove me to Albany, New York. Because my mother, because they had a sister, still have a sister that lives in Brooklyn, New York. So they kind of made it a family thing. They took me to school, dropped me off, and then they went down to Brooklyn to visit their sister, and then they came back to Roanoke. And that was quite an experience.
After graduating from graduate school?
I came back to Roanoke, and I went to work for George Franklin at the OICs of America, which was located under the, I think it was the east end of the old Victory Stadium. And I worked for George for about a year and learned a lot there. working for him, George was a very enterprising person. His executive assistant was the late Greta Evans. That's when I first met Greta. And his complex manager was Mr. John Divers, still living. Mr. Divers has been with me part of my life for a number of years. We are related, and my memory of him was he was the head maintenance person at Booker T. Washington Junior High School. He worked for the school system, and back in those days, the staff, the support staff at the schools were an integral part of the school family. And, you know, they would get involved in discipline and coaching and mentoring and all different kinds of things. And I recall seeing him every day. And his only question was, are you behaving yourself? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, okay. Because I know he'd tell my mom. Or what? So, anyway, Mr. Divers worked there, and many other people who lived in or who had roots in the Gainsborough community. So, I worked for George for a year, and then I left and went to Martinsville, Virginia, to become a criminal justice planner for the West Piedmont Planning District Commission. And this was like 1975. And I worked for the Planning District Commission from 1975 until 1978. And in December of 1978, I returned to Roanoke to become the Human Resources Planner for the City of Roanoke. And from there, I became the Chief of Community Planning. And from there, I became the Assistant City Manager. And then I left Roanoke again. After 14 and a half years with the city, I left Roanoke in February of 92 to become the city manager of Martinsville. And thought I would only do that for a couple of years and then maybe come back to Roanoke or some other community. And I ended up staying in Martinsville 3 months shy of 12 years. So I had a pretty long run there. So I arrived back in Roanoke in December. December seems to be a month for me. Arrived back in Roanoke in December of 2003 to assume the post of Deputy Executive Director of the Roanoke Redevelopment and Housing Authority. So I'm back.
Earl, let's talk a little bit about your school life. You've told us about some of the education that you have had, but let's go back to elementary school and talk a little bit about the schools that you attended.
Great time. Good people. Again, very community-oriented, community-focused, because the teachers and the support staff either lived in or had roots in the Gainsborough community. First grade, Mrs. Turpin. Second grade, Mrs. Turpin. Third grade, Mrs. Clark. Fourth grade, Mrs. Stovall, Elaine Stovall. Fifth grade, Mrs. Holland. Sixth grade, Mrs. Patterson. And of course, there were other instructors involved in my education as well. Memorable among those was a gentleman by the name of John Dillon and Mrs. McCadden, who taught home economics. And in her class, I made my mother an apron. My mother's deceased now, but that apron is still at 331 Harrison Avenue in the drawer. And every now and then I get it out and look at it. Then Booker T. Washington Junior High School. By the way, the schools were positioned so we could walk. There was no busing. So I walked to Harrison, I walked to Booker T. Booker T. was 7th, 8th, 9th grade back in those days. Again, junior high school. They don't call it that anymore. A place where, you know, kind of an incubator. The principal was Mr. Sidnor. The vice principal was Mr. Austin, who also lived on Harrison Avenue in Gainsborough. So he was right down the street. Teachers that I recall of note, Mrs. Allen, Mrs. Moore, Mrs. Poindexter, Eunice Poindexter. I took speech and grammar, and I shall never forget the first day in her class. And she was an elegant lady and a very well-spoken lady. She looked at us and she said, "Class, my name is Mrs. Poindexter." She said, "Repeat that." And the entire time I was in her class, the thing that she stressed was that you have to have a mastery of the King's English. And she made a big impression on me. The late Mr. Peary was a homeroom teacher of mine, as well as a science teacher. Mrs. Coleman, Sally T. Coleman. Mrs. Ennis taught me French. And, you always leave out somebody. But there are many, many others. Mr. Chubb, I was in his class. He would oftentimes say, "Run, don't see me after school." I was in his after school class, for cutting up sometimes. And a memory there is in Lincoln Terrace, now called the Villages at Lincoln. But the Lincoln Terrace community, there was a store. It's called Neighbors Confectionery. And family owned, Mr. and Mrs. Neighbors. And they had the best hot dogs in the city. At least we thought so. And we planned a great escape. It was about six of us. And we planned a circuitous route to the store at lunchtime so we could have hot dogs. And, you know, in order to get back to the next class and not be missed or detected. And of course, there were a lot of eyes around the school. One of them being the biggest hurdle that we had was to get past John Divers. John Divers was always watching to make sure the kids weren't leaving the campus when they weren't supposed to, etc. So somehow or another, we thought we got past Mr. Divers. He saw us and reported it to the office. And Mr. Austin, Lloyd Austin, shows up at the store. We had just finished eating those hot dogs. And he walks in, and he's got the Board of Education. All right. And he says, okay, get out here and line up. And so we came out of the store, and we lined up. And he walked us back down that hill into the office, where we got a paddling for being off campus. And then we had to sit there while each parent was called. My mother and dad worked. So my dad had to leave the barbershop and come get me because I got suspended for the remainder of the day. And needless to say, that was not something that I wanted to have to face my dad. To account for that. So, the hot dogs were good, but it was a terrible price to pay for what happened after that. Then from Booker T, he had a business in the community here. He was a bricklayer, but he was also a shop teacher at Booker T. There were two shop teachers. One was Mr. Atkinson, and he taught woodworking and that kind. And then there was another shop teacher that taught us the masonry trade, how to work with concrete bricks and that kind of thing. And he also had a business where he did that for contractors. And I will think of his name in just a minute. But moving on to Lucy Addison High School, I mean, that was a big deal. I got to take you back to when I was a kid and sitting on the sidewalk in front of the house on Harrison Avenue, 4 or 5 years old. And the highlight of the day, I'd get up every morning just to sit out there and watch the kids walk to Lucy Addison. Because that was a goal, that was a dream, to attend Lucy Addison High School. They were, always well dressed, books in hand. Some of the young men carried the young ladies' books, those kinds of things. And you would just sit there and you would just marvel. You just couldn't wait to grow up. To go to Lucy Addison. The other thing that kind of charged your senses was during the day. And we're at home. We're not even old enough to go to school. See, we're 4 or 5 years old. But during the day, the late Joe Finley was the band director at Lucy Addison. And he developed a band that was second to none. They actually played halftime at a pro football game in New York. My cousin was first trumpet. And I actually got to see him play on national TV. But anyway, they would practice during the day. And you could hear them all over the community. You know, we would just wait. And when we would hear the drums strike up, everybody sat down just to listen to that band. And during Christmas, they led the Roanoke City Christmas Parade every year. Every year. And people would just wait to see the Lucy Addison High School Band. And people would throw money at them when they marched down the street. They would actually throw money at them. Of course, Mr. Finley was a very smart and enterprising man. And after that happened the first year, the second year he was prepared, he had students that came behind the band with these buckets that picked up the money. And the money, of course, was used for instruments and to do other things at the school. But anyway, you arrive at Lucy Addison, and of course it's either you're going to play in the band, sing in the choir. They had also a tremendous choir that toured all over Virginia and outside of Virginia. Or either you play football or basketball. Right. Well, I was a football player. And so, the principal was, the late John Powell was the assistant principal. One of the assistant principals. Mr. Coleman was the assistant principal. But Mr. I'll remember it in a minute. Now, Mr. Day was my homeroom teacher. One of my homeroom teachers. It was Mr. When I graduated, the principal was Julian Moore. But when I started, I'll think of it. I knew it just a few minutes ago when I was talking about Mr. Atkinson and the others over at Booker T. But, and he was a great community leader, very active in the Hunt YMCA. I'll get to that. But anyway, there was a whole entourage of teachers over there at Lucy Addison. Again, I mentioned Mr. Day was my homeroom teacher for several years. The late John Powell, Mr. Skipper, the late Bernard Brown, who was our football coach, Joe Mormon, football coach, also physical education, health instructor, the late Irvin Kennedy, who also was in the football, basketball program, health, physical education, and science teacher. Mrs. Dorothy Whitten, who's still living across the street from Burl Moore Hospital. She taught me algebra. number of Mr. I'll never forget Mr. He taught me English grammar and composition. See his face. Just saw him a couple days ago.
Okay, Earl. How much schooling did any other person in your household complete?
My dad finished Lucy Addison High School, the old Lucy Addison High School, which was Booker T. And then, of course, the new high school we know as Lucy Addison, sits up on the hill there on Orange Avenue, was not built and opened until 1951. So everyone went to the old high school. And my mom did not finish high school. She eventually got her GED around 1965 or 1966. My sister did not finish high school. She eventually got her GED and then went on to get her associates from National Business College.
Okay, I want to talk about your home life a little bit. Describe your home life. For instance, did you gather around the radio, the TV, or when did you get the radio, TV, telephone?
Yes.
Describe some of the things that happened in your household.
Yes. So fun. That was a time that you related to your grandparents. They did a lot of the child rearing because mom and dad worked. My grandmother was always there. Everybody called her Aunt Georgie. And she was the king of what I call the tea towel. Back in the day, the older women would have this kitchen towel that they call a tea towel. And they always kept it on their shoulder because she was always washing dishes or had her hands wet or whatever. And then she grabbed this towel and dry her hands. Well, because the towel stayed moist or damp, it was also a treacherous weapon against kids. And whenever we got out of line, she would just pop you with that towel. And that would get you back in line real quick. I recall sitting with her and listening to the radio. And I remember listening to Richard Nixon, and he was vice president of the United States at that time. President of the United States was Dwight Eisenhower. And I remember listening to them talk about Korea, what was going on in Korea at that time. My grandfather obviously was an avid radio listener. That's what he grew up with, was radio. Guy Reynolds. And I remember listening to certain old radio shows with him. Amos and Andy, The Shadow, and those old shows that came on the radio. And also, there was always professional boxing on the radio. I remember listening to the fight between Floyd Patterson was fighting somebody. Sugar Ray Robinson and Dick Tiger and those boxers back in the 50s. And you listen to them on the radio. Probably the most dramatic thing that I saw on TV, we had an old black and white RCA with rabbit ears with aluminum foil on. And I saw with my grandmother and grandfather sitting there. Saw the funeral of John Kennedy. also saw the March on Washington and ML King's I Have Dream speech. I remember seeing that.
Do you remember your parents sitting on the front porch after dinner, talking to the neighbors or just talking to the children? Could you elaborate on that just a little bit for us?
Well, my mother was the community welcome wagon. She was known as the surrogate parent for all the kids. So there, a lot of kids stayed at my house all the time. You know, the door was always swinging. And in the evenings, I remember sitting out with her. Dad was always gone. But I remember sitting out on the porch with my mom. Well, early years, I was sitting out on the porch with my grandmother and grandfather. And then once my sister and I got to be teenagers, they moved. Because you see, there were only three bedrooms in the house. And my grandparents had a bedroom. My sister and I had a bedroom. And then, of course, my mom and dad. But once we got to be teenagers, my grandparents said, they need their own rooms. Okay. So they moved right behind us, right across the alley on Rutherford Avenue. And so my sister and I could have our own bedrooms. So then I recall sitting out with my mom and the neighbors next door. And they would just talk, you know, have these conversations about life and what was going on and those kinds of things. And, because back in those days, children were seen and not heard. So you would sit and you would listen to these adult conversations, but you never opened your mouth. You know, and that's kind of how you learn things, was to listen.
Okay, do you ever remember hearing a story about the Civil War or slavery or recipes or stories that were passed down from generation to generation? Generation, yes. You do remember that.
My grandmother and grandfather, they were from Patrick County. They were born and raised in Patrick County. My daddy was born in Patrick County and raised there until my grandparents moved to Roanoke. And recall my grandfather talking about working on farm in Patrick County and actually witnessing Ku Klux Klan activity, and he and some of his friends, you know, again, my granddaddy would take me with him downtown on the city market, and he and some of his friends would stand around and talk, and again, I'm standing there, and you know, you listen, you don't get involved in conversation, you just stand there, and I recall them talking about Klan activity, and they referred to them as the Kluxers. They would say, you know, I understand that, you know, the Kluxers did this, that, and the other in some community. And somebody said, yeah, I heard about that too. You know, that can, and of course, back then, you know, I'm trying to figure out Kluxers, what are they talking about? Because you dare not ask. You know, you just be quiet. And I also heard my grandmother talking about her experience growing up. She came from a large family. And when the girls got to be 19 years old, okay, they knew how to keep house, they knew how to take care of younger siblings, etc. And I remember her telling me that her mother, that she was asked for. That's okay. What does that mean? That means that there was a prominent lady in the community, white lady, who needed help. And heard that my grandmother was good with children and knew how to keep house and that kind of thing. So she went to my grandmother's mother and said, can I have Georgie Mildred? And they worked out the arrangement, and then she went to live with this lady and helped raise her children and keep her house. She said she ran away because the lady was mean to her. And she went back home. She ran back home. And the lady came back. And she said her mother said, no, you can't have Georgia. Yeah. Because you were mean to her. And that was a big thing back then, you know, to say no, particularly to a prominent family in the community, Caucasian family. So, I do remember her talking about that.
Did you, your spouse, siblings, children serve in the military?
No. Back during the days of Vietnam, I was in college. Now, I was subject to the draft, but I think it was two things that kept me out of the draft. I was number one, I was in college, and number two, I was my dad's only son. And back then, they would put you in a special category if you were the only surviving male in the family.
Okay. Yeah. What is your fondest childhood memory?
Probably Christmas in Gainesboro. It was just spectacular. Decorations. You know, again, the climate has changed quite a bit. Whatever global warming, whatever they want to call it, but we really had winters, and there would most of the time, somewhere around Christmas, there would be snowfall, and so just gearing up for the holiday season, the cooking, the smells, the community and church activities around the holidays, were always very, very nice.
What are some of your memories of the Gainesboro Library?
Oh, boy. Mrs. Lee, who also lived on Harrison Avenue. She lived about five houses down from me, about five. And I would see her every day. She would walk to work, of course, down Harrison Avenue, right over here to the library. And the many, many programs that she initiated for us, more particularly the reading programs, that was her number one thing, is that if you're going to survive, if you can't read, you can't learn. And so she was very regimented about that and created a lot of programs to entice us, to encourage us to read. And one of the programs that I recall was what we call the Gold Star Program. Every time you read so many books, you got a gold star. And it was on the board right over here. She had a board, and she had all the kids' names on it. And whenever you read so many books, you get a gold star. And then at the end of a certain reading period, whoever had the most stars would get some type of recognition. Of course, I was very competitive, so I was always trying to hang in there and win that prize, whatever it was. So, that door would swing every day. I'd be in here every day. And she said, Earl, are you sure you read these books? And I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, come over here. And see, you learn. The librarian reads also. And the books that I would select, she would always, either she had read them or she had some knowledge of them. And so she would talk to me about the books to make sure that I wasn't cheap, that I actually read these books. And see, the word gets around that, Miss Lee is going to ask you about these books. So, you can't just read the first chapter and the last chapter and take the book back to the library. You got to read it from cover to cover. So, just coming down here and being exposed to that kind of mentoring meant a lot to all of us here in the community. And again, right across the street was the Hunt and Why, and there was Mr. Heller, who I recall was one of the work managers over there. He looked out for us and created activities for us as well. And one of my coaches, I guess you could call it, little league football coaches, a gentleman by the name of Sammy Davis, also worked there as well. And of course, Mr. Keeling, the late Mr. Keeling, who also did a lot to further the programs that they're at the Y, and to try to move it to another level by joining with the main Y downtown. I think that happened during his administration as well.
Earl, I remember when you had a daughter, the first time you had your daughter. She was very little, and you came to the library, and we could not believe you brought your daughter to the same library that you grew up in, and the age that she was still in diapers, and she was still in the carrying case.
Right.
And tell us about that. And right today, Ashley comes in, she's a law student now, but when she comes home for the weekends, more than likely Ashley is here.
That's right.
In the library, getting right. books, reading books. So I think you started that a long time ago. Could you elaborate on that just a little bit because of my experience?
Yeah. When she was old enough to just take her out in the community, I always took her with me everywhere I went. That was back in the days before mandatory child safety seats and all that kind of thing. So she rode right in the front seat of the car with me right up on the little armrest. And, you know, I would bring her here to the library because I wanted her to get accustomed to books, to learning, that whole process of learning. One of my fondest memories is taking her up to Harrison Elementary School. Now, this was before Mrs. Thompson mounted her campaign to have the school renovated, which now houses the Harrison Museum of African American History. So when I took her up there to the schoolyard, the school was vacant, abandoned, and run down. And I set her there in the schoolyard and told her the story of Harrison Elementary School and what it meant to me and the community, and why it was important that we do something with that building. To make sure that that story continued to be told. So ever since she was, I had heard someplace, I don't know where, maybe I read it, that infants are just incubators for learning. And even though they can't talk, if you talk to them, they understand. So from the time Ashley was born, I talked to her. You know, and I would tell her stories, and I would take her places. And I could see that she was just like a sponge. She was absorbing this stuff. And so I just kept doing.
Okay, we just have one or two more questions. And I would just like to ask, who were some of your role models or community leaders when you grew up? You mentioned quite a few of them. But did you have one or two in particular that you said, this is my role model?
Well, there were just so many folks in the community. First of all, the older gentlemen in the community, irrespective of their jobs, were always very well dressed. So that kind of set the tone for us. You know, it wasn't about this, you know, walking around holding pants up kind of stuff. You know, it was all about, presentation, how you present yourself. By the way, the real quick story on that. When I first got back here from college and was having a difficult time finding a job, one of my drawbacks was I didn't have a car. Had an education, no car. I was riding around on the bus trying to go to places and get employment. And so I remember something my dad had told me. My dad always told me, he said, you don't, even though you don't have any money, you don't have to look like it. So, I put a suit and tie on, and I went downtown to the bank. And I saw the loan officer, a gentleman by the name of Joe Judy. And I said, Mr. Judy, I don't have a job yet. I'm having difficulty finding a job because of transportation. I need a car. And he looked at me, and and he said, wrote down a name, and he said, see this gentleman up at the Buick place, which was at that time, was located across from Jefferson High School on West Campbell Avenue. And so I went up there, and I gave him that note. He said, yes, Mr. Judy called and said you were on the way. And he said, do you see something you like? And they had this 1973 Buick Riviera sitting on the showroom floor. And I said, yeah, I like that car right there. And the price tag on it at that time, a brand new Buick back in those days, was $5,400. That was a lot of money. And he said, come on in the office. And he wrote it up. And he got on the phone and he called Judy. And in an hour, he gave me the keys. He said, that's your car. I didn't have a job. But what Mr. Judy told me, he said, you got potential. And he said, I knew that you would be able to pay these notes. He said, after you got a job. That's also a story that relates to local banking, hometown banking, as opposed to the banking that we have today. The bankers knew everybody in the community. And so they were able to do those kinds of things to help families and individuals, which is kind of tough today because the banking industry has changed so much. But anyway, I was the recipient of that as well as the recipient of the good advice of my father that, you know, because you don't have any money, you don't have to look like it. Okay. Now back to the original question, and that was other folks in the community who were like role models. Mr. and Mrs. Barlow at the hotel, Dumas Hotel. They were a very outstanding family in the community, and particularly Mrs. Barlow took a lot of time to mentor the young people. And she came in contact with us because at the Dumas Hotel, there was a malt shop, if you want to call it that. It was called Jack and Jill, named after her daughters. And we all went in there, and she had an opportunity to interact with us and you know, encourage us with our education and, you know, our behavior. You know, I saw you doing this the other day. Don't you do that anymore? You know, that kind of thing. Mr. and Mrs. Kaiser, Kaiser's Record Shop, you know, business people, as Mrs. Kaiser was just a tremendous lady, taught me the value of, she also taught me the value of reading. She would just read, and, you know, her husband worked, he worked at the VA Medical Center, but he also was an entrepreneur. He owned the record shop. So, you know, that teaches you the, again, the work ethic, that you got to work for what you get. There was another gentleman who owned the Palace Hotel on the Henry Street. His name was Billy Salters. We called him Uncle Billy. And his business was the jukebox business. Okay. Back in the day, all right, you had the jukeboxes with the records in them. You know, you pay your money and we play the record, right? So he had jukeboxes in very remote locations throughout the community that the other folks would not serve. So he kind of filled that niche. Yeah, another person that did that, who built a business around filling the niche, was A. Byron Smith. He was another person in the community who was very outstanding. Person, Connie Hamler, you know, she was in the real estate business, physicians in the community, attorneys in the community, Judge Harris, who's now, well, he's judge now, Judge Harris, but when he was an attorney on Henry Street, Attorney Lawson. Ministers in the community, R. Wilkerson, E.T. Burton, Noel Taylor, you know, just on and on. All of those folks, because they came through Henry Street. And I had that kind of contact and relationship with folks that you would always look up to.
Earl, thank you. We really appreciate you coming in to interview with us. And is there anything else you would like to tell us that we didn't ask today?
I guess we just kind of covered the waterfront here. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much. Okay.